I suppose there is no editor of either a magazine or a newspaper in America with more influence than Norman Cousins, editor of the Saturday Review. He often analyzes the problems of our time and tries to come with a solution. Some time ago, he wrote an article on our quest for peace in the world. He suggested that we have a tragic flaw in our efforts, either individually or nationally, to get along with other people. And that flaw is a total subjectivity when we face the problem between us and another person. We tend to see only our side of it. And so instead of learning how to deal with war, we simply invent new ways of handling war, new strategies for it, new political approaches to try to overcome it. But he goes on to say that unless some new impulse or energy is found some way, no organization, not the UN, not anything else, will be able to do very much about the problem of war among men. It seems to me a rather serious indictment when 900 million people in the world claim to be followers of Jesus Christ, and yet no impulse can be found that has the energy, the power, to overcome the conflicts among men. There's a dire need for a rediscovery of who Jesus was and what he taught, and the kind of life we would produce if we were really following him. Last Sunday morning, as we started our look at the personality of Christ, I mentioned a book published in 1858 by Horace Bushnell. It was a time of widespread unbelief. The rationalism of the modern period had really taken root, and there was a wide overthrowing of the scripture. Bushnell, a New England minister who was rather liberal doctrinally himself, came with a book of apologetics called Nature and the Supernatural. It had one section that was especially striking. It came to be excerpted and printed separately, called The Character of Christ, Forbidding His Classification with Men. He based the whole claim of the Christian religion on the kind of person Jesus was. And I used that as a starting point last week to pull out one of Jesus' characteristics, honesty, and we looked at it carefully. Today I want to pull out one other one, meekness, and take a careful look at it. It may be that if we could rediscover the characteristics in our lives that he had in his, if we could put them into practice, we would be heard in a way that the world is needing to hear something. Surely there's a possibility of the personality of Jesus having an answer to the problems the world faces. If anyone asks why start with Jesus, the answer is that the Christian hasn't any other starting place. This is his point of direction, his point of departure. He believes that the solutions of the problems of mankind are found in the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. Now, if you ask why start with meekness, that's another question. Maybe we should start with something manlier. I think that would be the normal reaction. Maybe courage, maybe determination. Jesus had those characteristics, but one of our problems is that we don't have a correct appreciation for the other characteristics, like meekness and honesty. Meekness has had what we would call a bad press. That is, the wrong kind of report has gotten out about it. It has been misunderstood and misrepresented by its own friends as well as by its foes until it has come to mean a doormat for other people to walk on. The person who is meek is the kind of person who has a listless acceptance of whatever comes. If anyone wishes to do him wrong, he's welcome because he'd like to be trampled on by somebody. It would be evidence of his meekness. I think we've formed that kind of impression of this characteristic which was fundamental to the personality of Jesus Christ, and it's a wrong impression. Some years ago, Leo Durocher was a rather outstanding name in the sports world, player, manager. And in a hot pennant race for the baseball crown, Durocher was asked what he thought of a fellow manager, Mel Ott. Durocher's reply was often harsh. His words and actions both were harsh at times. And he said, Mel's a nice guy, but nice guys often always finish last in this league. I've often thought that if you put meekness into the niceness there, this person is a meek fellow, but meek fellows always finish last in this world. That would be a pretty good characterization of the way we feel about meekness. But meek is a rather rich word. It has a Hebrew background and a Greek background that could help us in redefining and help us to appreciate the principle. There's an Old Testament word, anah, which comes to be translated into English as meek or lowly or humble. It's not the same as the word for humility. That word often implied, especially to the Greek people, a kind of self-abasement that was unworthy of life. But this word has a different kind of background. The man who has meekness or humility or lowliness in this sense is one of the favorite characters of the Psalms, for example. He's a man who obviously trusts God. He loves God. He obediently does God's will. His only concern is to place his whole life in the hands of God. He believes that whatever comes to him, even though it's a Gethsemane or a Calvary, is somehow coming to him in God's providence, and that God knows best, and that life will always bring him a set of circumstances he can deal with God's help, that he'll be able to emerge from those circumstances with God working in everything that happens to him for good. That kind of character is the person who is favored, as I said, in the Psalms often. In Psalm 10, for example, verse 17, O Lord, thou wilt hear the desire of the meek. Thou wilt strengthen their heart. Thou wilt incline thy ear. God listens to the desire of the meek person in this sense. In Psalm 25, verse 9, he leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. God not only hears the desire of the humble, he leads them and teaches them his way. In Psalm 147, the Lord lifts up the downtrodden. He casts the wicked to the ground. Our impression is that if the meek inherit the earth, they'll simply be ground into it. That if they inherit it for a time, the strong eventually will take it away from them. But the Psalms are emphasizing, and Jesus was quoting Psalm 37:11, when he said, Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The Psalms are emphasizing that God lifts up the meek man. The proud man is the one who's going to be ground down. In Psalm 149, verse 4, the Lord takes pleasure in his people. He adorns the humble with victory. The Proverbs often mention the meek too, and I've just chosen a sprinkling out of the Psalms. Proverbs 3:34 says, Toward the scorners, God is scornful, but to the humble, he shows favor. The book of Isaiah picks up the same theme. In Isaiah 11, there's a prophecy about a root coming forth, or a shoot coming forth, rather, from the root of Jesse, a prophecy of Jesus Christ coming into the world. With righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. When Jesus comes, he's going to decide with equity for the meek person. And finally, in Isaiah 29, verse 19, the meek shall obtain fresh joy in the Lord, and the poor among men shall exult in the Holy One of Israel. God hears the desire, he lifts up, he guides, he gives joy to the meek person. Obviously, the meek person is highly respected in the Old Testament. The Greek background is just as wealthy, except that we don't have the same amount of scriptural background for it. But the Greek language itself uses the word praos for the meek man. And it's a word Aristotle uses as he's always discussing virtues and putting the virtue somewhere between two extremes. The extreme, for example, for a man may be recklessness. He'll run into any danger without ever a second thought. But the opposite extreme is cowardice. The man will not face anything if there's any danger in it. And the mean between those, which Aristotle admired, was courage. Neither recklessness nor cowardice, but courage. When he discusses meekness, Aristotle makes it apply to anger. And meekness to him is the golden mean, the happy medium, between too much anger and angerlessness. A person may be hot-tempered, quick to anger over any subject, or he may be the kind of person who will be willing to be walked on. He'd never become angry over anything. No matter what's done to another person that's wrong, no matter what's done to God's will, he just never becomes angry. Somewhere between those two, too much anger and angerlessness, Aristotle puts meekness. The Greeks used it for a horse that's been tamed to the point that he will listen when the reins are pulled and respond. Or they use it of a sheepdog who has heard the loving voice of a master to the point that he's trained. He knows what to do and he's willing to obey it. Plato uses it of the guardian of the state, who he says is a gentleman and yet a spirited man. He's a man who is disciplined and yet he has some fire about him. It's used of an individual who has a great deal of power but doesn't necessarily use all of the power he has. He might, as a king, enforce strict discipline on anyone who does something against his will, or he might generously show forgiveness. In showing that forgiveness, he shows a characteristic of meekness. So the background of the word is a word describing a man who is loving and trustful and obedient to God, and a man who's in control, a man who is disciplined, a man whose energies are challenged, who is spiritually trained. And you can be sure that the trained person will triumph over the untrained person every time. It's just as true in spiritual training. The person who channels those energies, who learns to control that anger, who learns to respond in the right way at the right time to the circumstances of life, that's the meek person who's being described here. Meekness has its application toward God, toward other people, and toward oneself in the Scripture. A meekness toward God I've talked about a bit. It's an attitude toward God, a belief in His providence, a real belief in the presence and the promptings of God, an awareness and openness to the leadership of God, a willingness to follow in whatever direction He takes us through His care. That's meekness. It's what you find in Job in chapter 1 when he says, "The Lord gave, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord," when he had lost everything he had. It's the attitude of Job in chapter 13 when it seemed he might lose his life. And he said, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust him." It's the attitude of Mary, the mother of Jesus, when she learned she was going to have a child who would fulfill the prophecies God made to Abraham and to David. And she said in Luke 1, verse 38, "Behold the handmaiden of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word." She was simply saying, "Your will be done in my life." It's the attitude of Saul of Tarsus when his resistance was finally broken and he said, "Lord, what wilt thou have me to do?" in Acts 9. Meekness. It's a characteristic of being willing to obey God, to lovingly follow His will wherever it leads. It also has an application toward other men, an involvement in other people's lives. The real key to anger as to whether it's right or wrong is the question of whether it's for myself or whether it's for somebody else. An involvement with others means that occasionally one is going to be angry. But the right kind of anger is not over a wrong done to himself, it's over a wrong done to others. That's the way Jesus was. He could take any kind of insult, provocation, and respond with meekness. But when someone was willing to wrong another person, Jesus could respond with anger. In Mark 3rd chapter, it was the Sabbath day. There was a man with a withered hand in the presence of Jesus, and Jesus wanted to help him. The Orthodox scribes and Pharisees were just standing around to see what he would do because their regulation said that no deed of mercy could be done on the Sabbath day, no deed of any kind. As they watched Jesus, Mark says, he looked about on them with anger because of the hardness of their hearts and said to the man with a withered hand, "Stretch forth thy hand." And he stretched it forth, and it was restored whole as the other one. Jesus looked with anger when people didn't care about the suffering of another person. Perhaps the best known scene is in John 2nd chapter, when he went into the temple in Jerusalem and found the tables of the money changers, men making money off the poor pilgrims who'd come to Jerusalem to worship by selling them the animals they needed in the sacrifice or trading them a coin they had to have to pay the temple tax and charging them for it in a way that they could make money for themselves. Jesus said, "You've made my Father's house, which was supposed to be a house of worship, a den of thieves." And he became the Lord of the whip instead of just the Lord of love. We think about if the whip has a contradiction with love, because he drove them out. There's a meekness toward God that respects his will, a meekness toward other men that has the other person's interest at heart, and then there's a meekness toward the self. The meek person realizes that he's a child of God, and that is the most important truth about his life. Everything else is determined by that. Self-centeredness is not allowable. Instead, the body he has is the temple of God's Spirit, 1 Corinthians 3. The relationships he has are relationships given by God. They're precious gifts, and they're used under God. Everything about him is brought into the control of God's will. This is the meek man. I doubt whether any characteristic, honesty or meekness or anything else, ever becomes alive to us until we see it incarnate. In all the Bible, there are lots of meek persons, but there are only two people that the Bible ever stresses meekness in connection with a discussion of their character. Two people whose characteristic is described primarily in terms of meekness. One of them is Moses. In Numbers 12th chapter, Moses was leading Israel, and his brother Aaron, who had often been his spokesman, his sister Miriam, decided that Moses had taken too much authority on himself. And they led a kind of revolt against him. Miriam became leprous, you may remember. But the point of the passage emphasizes that Moses was the meekest man in all the earth. He wasn't seeking power. He was seeking a loving, trustful obedience to God's will. If you go back and trace out the meekness of Moses, it starts with his call. Moses had tried to help the Israelites who were enslaved. He'd been reared by Pharaoh's daughter. He found an Egyptian punishing an Israelite, killed him, buried his body in the sand. The next day he tried to settle a problem between two Israelites, and the one in the wrong said, "Who made you a judge or a ruler over us? Are you going to kill me like you did that Egyptian yesterday?" And Moses knew he had to flee. The Israelites were not accepting his leadership, and what he had done was known. So he went into the land of Midian, over near Mount Sinai. There he found an oasis, married, kept his father-in-law's sheep, lived for an extended time, 40 years. At the end of that period, Moses was out tending the sheep one day when he saw a bush burning but not consumed. He drew near out of curiosity and was struck with terror by what he heard. God told Moses to leave that oasis of quietness and go back to tense Egypt and all its turmoil. Lead those people out. And this is the way Moses began to respond. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" But God began to answer him, "I've chosen you." In Exodus 4:1, Moses answered again, "Behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice. They will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" And God gave him signs to show that he had appeared to him. But Moses said to the Lord, "O my Lord, I'm not eloquent, either heretofore or since thou hast spoken to thy servant. I'm slow of speech and of a slow tongue." God said, "Moses, who made man's mouth? Who made his tongue? Who gave you speech? There's Aaron. He can speak for you." And then Moses came with his final objection. But he said, "O my Lord, send, I pray, some other person." If you haven't felt that way in the midst of some challenge, you really haven't faced a serious enough challenge yet. But Moses was just on the point of refusal, but he couldn't refuse. Once he took that mantle of responsibility, though, he held those people together. When their courage failed, they wanted to go back into Egypt at any price, Moses kept them going forward. When they were filled with dissension, splitting themselves apart, he pulled them back together. The accomplishments of the man were great because he was a meek man. He constantly followed the will of God. The other person about whom the term is used is Jesus. Matthew 11:29, "I am meek and lowly in heart, and you shall find rest to your souls." Or Matthew 21:5, quoting from Zechariah 9, "Behold, thy king cometh unto thee meek, and riding on an ass, and a colt, the foal of an ass." His triumphal entry into Jerusalem, we call it, but it wasn't too triumphant that day. He was coming humbly, and the very people who were spreading the leaves before him were pretty shallow. They were soon to turn against him and cry out, "Crucify him." But the meekness of the man Jesus is emphasized throughout the Gospels, whether with the word or not. Again, it's a characteristic of a person who is willing to follow the Father's will wherever it leads. What did he accomplish? I'd be rather presumptuous to try to sum up his accomplishments in a few brief minutes. But he's the pivot of all human history. Everything that has ever happened is related somehow to him. He was the desire of the ages before him, and he's the one we look back to for direction. He spent most of his life as a carpenter in Nazareth of Galilee. The closing years of his life, he preached in the highways and villages of Israel. His critics heaped accusations against him until he finally died alone, so far as friends were concerned. His only companions were two thieves. And yet, the stamp of his character is left on human history in a way that we again go back and explore one little facet of it in detail because it's so worthy of imitation. The tragic flaw that keeps the world from finding peace. Too self-centered in our own problems, never interested enough in solving the problem by understanding the position of the other person. Some new energy, some new impulse is needed But Cousins said in his editorial, where it is to come from is not clear at all. Where is it to come from? A generation so well trained in mind as ours needs to be trained in the Spirit. I've been encouraged in recent years with a number of articles I've seen by scientific men who insist that science must find some values in the field of religion. Because the wonderful things science can produce for us can ruin us, destroy us, unless somehow values are found that are worthy of being lived by. We need a generation trained in the Spirit as well as trained in the mind. And meekness is one of those characteristics of the Spirit. In its Hebrew background, a man who lovingly, obediently trusts God and follows wherever he leads. In its Greek background, a disciplined person who channels his energies and is kept under control. And when the two are brought together, a person who is ultimately not self-controlled or self-disciplined, but a person who is controlled by God. That's the significance of the word. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Jesus was not promising a bit of real estate in that beatitude. He was saying in a far deeper way that the greatest things in the earth belong to the people who possess this characteristic of life. In a real way, they inherit the earth and the life to come. But that sort of life begins with loving, trustful obedience to God. Would you, while we sing?